For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether it means suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics. Our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. I'm Don Mazzella, the program of Small Business Digest, and Rob Gremley, CEO of ETQ, ETQ, is here to talk about ensuring that your brand grows and prospers. Rob, welcome to the program.
Don, thank you for having me on the program today.
Well, first, Rob, tell us a little bit about yourself personally and a little bit about your company before we do anything else.
Don, as you mentioned, I'm the CEO of a company here in Boston, Massachusetts called ETQ. ETQ was founded about 2.5 decades ago, and that ETQ acronym stands for Excellence Through Quality, ETQ. That sort of homage to quality is what really drives the company here. We're a company that provides enterprise software to companies of all sizes, small and large, to help them manage their quality processes. And as you can imagine, paying attention to quality, understanding the implications of really great quality, and sometimes, unfortunately, poor quality can have huge implications on the success of your business. So we're a company that really comes to work every day thinking about how we can help companies of all sizes and across many different industries help them to improve their ability to produce high-quality products and services on a regular basis.
Rob, I'm going to interrupt you a moment because that's an interesting point. You bring up the word quality, and I'm going to ask you to stop everything and define what you mean by quality because we all have differing visions of it.
Don, that's a great sort of opening question, and thank you for that. Maybe the best way to sort of introduce the notion of quality is through our own experiences and the way that we might, as consumers, experience quality in our everyday lives. I would contend that as we sort of go through our day as daily consumers here, that we are in either consciously or subconsciously, we are making determinations of quality throughout the day. And I'll give you a very sort of easy example, and that is when you go and get your Starbucks coffee in the morning. When you walk into that Starbucks and you order a latte for $4, and that barista makes the coffee for you, the latte for you, and hands it to you, the minute that you take a sip of that latte, you are making a determination of quality. Whether you kind of realize it consciously or whether it's happening subconsciously, you're making a determination about how that latte tastes, whether it was the right temperature, whether it is what you expected based on the fact that you've ordered a latte many times prior from Starbucks. You're making a determination about the friendliness of the staff and the cleanliness of the store. And all of those sort of sensory contributions are culminating in your decision about whether you're having a quality process, sort of a quality experience or not. And yeah, it's a small sort of experience in your day to get a latte from Starbucks. But what Starbucks is doing behind the scenes is ensuring that when you step foot in any Starbucks around the world, that when you pay that $4 for that latte, that it's a high quality experience. You say, boy, this is the best latte that I've had today, and I'm coming back to Starbucks tomorrow. And I think one of the things that we as consumers maybe don't expect or realize is that there's a what I call mega machine of quality that exists inside of Starbucks to make sure that when you sip that latte, you're having a really great experience. You feel good about handing over your $4 for that latte. And there's a whole series of people, a lot of technology, and many, many quality processes that are sort of behind that latte, if you will. And Starbucks spends a tremendous amount of energy and money investing to make sure that you have a good quality experience. And I would contend that that one Starbucks experience happens perhaps hundreds of times throughout the course of the day, whether it's a retail experience you're having, whether it's closing the door on your car and your car either starts or doesn't start is a determination of quality. So I think we as consumers are confronted with quality every day, and that we are the benefactors of these huge investments, these mega machines of quality, all the people and process and technology that have to go into making sure that we have a good experience as a consumer.
Okay. Now, having said that, how does your company help a small company maintain and grow quality?
That's, a very good question. And Don, as I mentioned earlier, we are a software company, and what we would determine or call an enterprise software company, meaning that we sell business-to-business software. So we would sell to businesses like Starbucks more so than selling to consumers. So we're not really selling apps that run on your iPhone or selling desktop software. We're selling software that companies use to ensure that they can deliver that high-quality product. And interestingly, we sell to companies that are very small, could be a five-person startup, let's say, who's coming up with some innovative new medical device, or we sell to some of the largest brands in the world, companies like Coca-Cola and General Motors and American Airlines are all customers of ours as well. So we sell to very small companies and we sell to very large companies. And you would say, well, what is it that is sort of the common denominator? What's the common thread between really small companies, startups, and really, really big companies? And that's that they both have to spend a tremendous amount of energy ensuring high quality. One way to think about quality as a product attribute or a brand attribute of a company is that quality is kind of sizeless. It is equally applicable to the success of small companies as it is to the success of very, very large companies. And maybe thinking about that through a different lens a little bit is that quality problems, which some companies unfortunately have to deal with sometimes, quality problems are kind of indiscriminate about whether they're going to appear in front of a small company that might be a one-product company trying to get a product out the door for the first time and is having quality problems, or whether it's a very, very large company and is having quality problems where perhaps the publicity of it is much bigger, they themselves have to wrestle with it. So quality is first of all, kind of sizeless. It's important to small companies as it is to large companies, and it's indiscriminate about where it's going to show up in business, small companies or large companies. And because of that, companies of all sizes need to lean on mechanisms to help them ensure high quality. Sometimes it's the hiring of quality managers that know how to manage a quality process inside of a company. Sometimes it's relying on technology, and that's where our company, ETQ, really comes in, is that we build and market and support a piece of software that helps companies, small and large, to be able to manage the business processes that underpin high quality. So if you could think about things like managing a complaint process or managing what we would call a non-conformance. You find something that's non-conforming in your manufacturing line. How are you going to go deal with that? Training of your workforce to make sure that your workforce is certified and trained perhaps on a manufacturing floor to run a certain piece of machinery. There's a series of business processes that underpin, I'll go back to that word, mega machine of quality, series of business processes that we help to enable and optimize, and we do it through software.
We're talking with Rob Gremley. He's CEO of a love company, ETQ. But I'm going to go a little sideways, Rob, because you're really talking about a concept that's very difficult for people to put their hands around, leastwise the people I've talked to and certainly myself. But for instance, if you're a manufacturer of waste paper baskets, and you have to turn out 100,000 waste paper baskets, which are, in effect, the rolled steel imprint. Is your software helping me identify when mistakes are made and how to fix them. And if you use another example, make sure that the person using that the equipment is trained. Is that what you mean by your company?
Great question, Don. And in fact, I'm going to give you two answers to the two parts of your question, because your example of a rolled steel waste basket with an imprint on it, your first question is, would we help to determine whether that rolled steel waste paper basket is being manufactured correctly or not? In other words, we intend for it to be round. Is it really round when it comes off the manufacturing line? And we intend for it to have a logo stamped into it. Is the logo stamped correctly, or perhaps is the logo upside down for some reason? That area of quality is more often referred to as quality assurance or QA. And quality assurance is a different sort of a sister related type of quality software. It's not what we produce, but it is certainly important in the production of a high quality product, in this case our rolled steel waste paper basket. But think of quality assurance more as inspection and test. I create that waste paper basket, I then take some measurements off of it, and I determine whether it meets the right dimensions and specifications or tolerances that I expect it to. That would be inspection and test under the category of quality assurance. That type of software tends to live right on the manufacturing floor, where the machinery is making the software, the machinery is sort of making the waste paper basket, and we have software that helps to do that inspection and test. The category of software that ETQ produces, that we make here, is what's called quality management software. And it is a related space, but it's much more about controlling the business processes related to producing a high quality product. So I'm going to answer the second part of your question in the affirmative, which is to say, you know, your second question was, would we be keeping track of the person that's operating the machinery? And the answer is absolutely yes, we do. That operator has to be trained and certified and allowed to run a certain piece of machinery. In fact, we have one customer who has their operators have a magnetic badge that they have to swipe in to a card reader on the side of the machine when they check in the morning to run a certain manufacturing workstation. They have to swipe their badge, and that then sends off a little business process to check in our software whether or not that operator has been certified and is updated on the latest release and the latest manufacturing methods for that particular piece of machinery. And if they are, then the machinery will start and they can start performing their manufacturing duties. And if they are not, they can't even start the machine. So that's one small area of sort of managing the workforce, the certifications of the workforce, the training of the workforce. That is a very popular application of our software. I'll give you one more example. Complaint handling, particularly in consumer products, is a very important part of quality management, because many products that we buy these days have 1-800 numbers on the back of them. And I'll give you an example of a bag of M&Ms as an example. Mars Corporation is a customer of ours, big, large food and beverage manufacturer. They make M&Ms, and so if you are dissatisfied with the bag of M&Ms, let's say you opened up a bag of peanut M&Ms and realized that only half of the candy in there had peanuts in the middle, you might call that 1-800 number and complain. When you do that, a customer service representative is taking down the information about where did you buy it and what was wrong with that bag of M&Ms. Perhaps what's the lot number that's printed on the back of the bag. All of that information is captured in our software, and we are correlating that data entry, that one particular person that called. Let's say Don called and complained about the M&Ms that he got. We're putting that together with thousands of other calls to determine whether the Mars company has a manufacturing problem. Perhaps there is a machine that's out of calibration, and we can correlate that all back to a certain lot number. And so we're getting lots of complaints about a particular manufacturing lot number. It could be that I'm Staples and I bought a bunch of your rolled steel waste paper baskets and customers are complaining that the edges are too sharp. We'd want to know that and be able to correlate it back to a failure in our manufacturing process. So quality assurance, that inspection and test area, and quality management that we do here at ETQ are very interrelated. They're both important parts of the manufacturing process. For us, quality assurance tends to live on the shop floor a little closer. We tend to live more in the business of managing quality.
That was a very clear, even I understood it at the end of that. Thank you.
But now I
love this show because I get to learn an awful lot of things I never knew. And we are talking with Rob Remley. He is CEO of ETQ. And by the way, Rob, give a pitch for your website and spell it out for our audience.
Folks can visit us at www.ETQ. It stands for Excellence Through Quality, but it's really just the three letters, ETQ.com, www.ETQ.com. And you visit that website, you can learn a lot about case studies, customers like I've been talking about today, as well as what our products do in some very interesting ways. You can request a demo of the product. You can click on that little chat bot in the bottom right corner of the website, and someone will pick up the phone and talk to you.
Well, one other thing, how did you manage to get ETQ? It's always difficult to get three letters on a website today. How did you manage that?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it probably predates my time here at ETQ. But I would imagine, the company was founded about 23 years ago. So I think in the early days of the web, I would say the founding of the company kind of predates popular three-letter acronym websites. So we were probably pretty lucky to be able to grab that ETQ domain name. But we're certainly glad to have it.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you another question. Where do you fit in with the coming robotic revolution? And is your part of your work going to be integrating there as well?
That's a great question, Don, and the answer is absolutely yes. I would categorize robotics in together with things like IoT or the Internet of Things, all under the umbrella of kind of smart manufacturing. As manufacturers move more and more to connected machinery on the factory floor, things like robotics and connected devices generally are producing lots and lots of operational data on the manufacturing floor. All of that data that's coming off of that manufacturing line is like gold for us in determining quality and potential quality problems. And in fact, we work very closely with our customers to mix together that manufacturing data that's happening every day on the manufacturing floor in factories, connected factories. We mix that together with quality data, like I was talking about earlier, that complaint data, for instance. There's very powerful insights that can be gleaned by connecting manufacturing data from, say, a robot process together with quality management data that we're collecting in our software. And some of the most progressive companies in the world are mixing together that data to try to get ahead of quality problems so that they catch those problems before anybody in a consumer or a business world, their customers basically would find it. And so that kind of data off of connected manufacturing devices like robots, that's like gold to us.
Well, now let me ask you, from a small business perspective, I'm a small business. Why would I come to you, and what would be some of the problems that I'd be want to ask you to solve for me?
Don, I think one of the things that small companies, I think, are from a, particularly if you're a product company, let's say you're a product manufacturer, probably first and foremost is you have to design and develop a great new product, something that's going to be differentiable in the marketplace and carve out an interesting spot for you, perhaps in a new emerging market. Simply having the sort of innovation around the product and the product development process probably isn't enough. You have to be ready for the fact that if that ends up in the hands of a business buyer or, let's say, in more mass quantity, a consumer, they're going to make those determinations of quality that I talked about earlier, right? They are making those same types of daily experiences in the use of your product. So right out of the gate, as a small company, you have to have an eagle eye on quality. The large companies that have quality problems, in some respects, are kind of built to weather the storm better. They probably have multiple product lines, maybe hundreds of product lines. So if a problem exposes itself in one product line, maybe it, in some respects, might even get washed over a little bit. But if you're a small company, you might have one product line or two product lines. And therefore, the criticality of focusing on quality is heightened because of the fact that you got a smaller sample of products that your company, sort of the livelihood, viability of your company probably depends on the quality of those products. So the reason that small companies would come to us is to say, can you help us put quality processes in just like the big guys do? Because we have to worry about things like workforce training. We have to worry about things like people calling our 1-800 number and making complaints about the product potentially. We might have non-conformances in our manufacturing process that we have to jump on super quickly. And so we want really kind of big company quality, but at a small company price, because, you know, we're a startup company, and therefore we don't have a lot of money to spend. That's where the scalability of software like we produce is really valuable, that with really one product, one software product, we can scale it up for the needs of a General Motors or a Coca-Cola or an American Airlines, or we can scale it down to the, let's say, right size it to a very, very small company, and we can kind of start small, if you will, whereas we might have 35 or 40 processes, quality processes that we're managing for a Coca-Cola, we can start with two or three for a small company. And there's been so many advances in enterprise software technology over the years that make it much more approachable for small and mid-sized companies, not the least of which is software, enterprise software across the board is almost by nature available in the cloud these days. So you don't need to have a big IT department. You don't need to have data centers where you can load up kind of heavyweight on-premise enterprise software where you have to manage it and configure it and so forth. Software companies like ourselves have gotten very adept at being able to sell software and support software on a subscription basis. What you might hear this term SaaS, right? Software as a service. So rather than buying the software and owning it and having to support it and so forth, you can simply, in effect, rent the software, sign up for a subscription to, just like you do, you sign up for, in the old days, you used to sign up for a subscription to Sports Illustrated, and I kind of get it for a year. Now you can buy software that way as a small company. And when you do that, we don't ship you, you know, CDs or DVDs with software on it that you have to figure out how to install. We do all of that for you. We simply send you a link. We'll send you an email with a link in it. And you, when you click on that link in the email, you are then firing up your version of the software that lives in the cloud. It's configured for you. It's right-sized for you. It's sort of imminently approachable from a price perspective because you're starting small. You don't need that big heavyweight software that the big guys need. You need lightweight software that you as a small company need. And, you know, it's a big part of what we focus on here is making software very approachable for small and mid-sized companies. And, you know, the cloud's been a big piece of that.
We're talking with Rob Gremley. He's CEO of ETQ. Rob, we just have a couple of minutes left. What would you'd like to leave our audience with today?
Well, I think the most important thing is maybe to kind of rehash the conversation a little bit, that, you know, it's our belief here at ETQ that quality is sizeless. It's as meaningful. Perhaps I could make an argument that it's maybe even more strategically important for small companies than it is large, because the tolerance for mistakes is so much tighter on small companies. So quality is sizeless. It's sort of indiscriminate about where quality problems might emerge. And so therefore, starting with quality in mind as a small company is like super, super important. You know, big companies have a lot of money and a lot of people to spend on it. Small companies don't. Therefore, you know, we've tried to make the management of quality very approachable for small companies, at a price point that's available to small companies, that the technology is kind of right-sized for them and can be configured in the cloud, as I just said. I think that quality management software for small companies is imminently doable, imminently important, critically important, and very approachable.
We've been talking with Rob Gremley. He's CEO of ETQ. Rob, one last time, your website?
www.etq, Excellence Through Quality, etq.com.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's been fascinating and educational today. Thanks so much.
All right, John. Thanks for having us on the program. Really appreciate it.
No, we really appreciate that you came. Have a great day.
You as well. Bye now.
Today, I'd like to provide listeners with a brief legislative update for small businesses in the areas of privacy and cybersecurity. Currently, the federal government and many states are struggling with the concept of protecting privacy and regulating cybersecurity. As data breaches continue to accelerate across most industries and impact companies of all sizes, our state and national leaders continue to debate the proper approach to combat cybervillains. Since the federal government has not yet established a national framework for cybersecurity, many states are stepping in and passing a wide array of legislation. The state of New York was one of the first when it enacted cybersecurity regulations for financial institutions. The state of California has followed suit, passing the California Consumer Privacy Act, otherwise known as the CCPA, which provides California residents with a wide array of privacy rights. However, simultaneously, it also creates significant burdens for certain businesses which conduct business in the state. You might ask, why should small businesses care? They should care because these state laws and the debate in Congress will shape the future of cybersecurity for all businesses, big and small. And remember that 58% of all malware attacks are against small businesses, which put small companies in the middle of today's cyber battle. Recently, Congress acknowledged the impact a federal privacy framework might have on small businesses when the Commerce Subcommittee held a hearing to discuss concerns for small companies. Five witnesses representing a wide array of small businesses testified at the hearing, and there were some common themes. First, small businesses require and request a strong national framework. Federal preemption of state laws is of the utmost importance. And why? Because small businesses do not have the resources to comply with very different, potentially contradictory state laws from all 50 states. There are also calls for transparency, accountability, and consistency. They want a strong, yet simple and clear law that does not target small businesses. The overall key is to strike a balance between protecting privacy versus the cost or stunting the growth of small companies. Business leaders must keep abreast of these developing laws and regulations at the state and federal level. Lawmakers need your input. What is currently being debated will lay the foundation for the future of privacy law and cybersecurity in the United States. As you and your business will be impacted, best practice is to monitor and be prepared to act. Legal and business challenges are hard enough. The process to solve them doesn't have to be. Growing and thriving businesses throughout the United States trust the law firm of Neumeyer & Dillion for advice that propels them to success. From real estate and construction to telecommunications and hospitality, we help companies in diverse industry prepare for what's ahead. Visit us at ndlf.com. After all, Neumeyer & Dillion started as a small business itself, creating values and a culture built on expanding our role from just lawyers to fully invested strategic business partners. Now, nearly 35 years later, growing to over 70 attorneys across multiple offices, we have successfully represented our longstanding clients with all of their business needs. Whether it's privacy and data security, insurance coverage, labor and employment, business litigation, or a variety of offerings in between, we take your business as personally as you do, and we won't rest until you succeed. Visit our website to learn more about how we can help at ndlf.com, or contact me directly at Jeff, Jeff.Dennis, Dennis, at ndlf.com, and ask me about our small business cyber protection plan. Again, please visit us at ndlf.com.
I'm Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and we have an extraordinary guest who served our country in a variety of roles and has written an outstanding book. Larry Davis, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Don. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Larry, tell us a little bit about your background, then the name of your fabulous book, which I've read. It helps any person that's always worried if he or she has gone on the stage and worried that their fly is open.
Well, my background is probably somewhat unusual for a speech coach. I'm a retired Army colonel, but as I often say, I did more speaking than I did shooting. And I had a couple of assignments that led directly into what I do as a speech coach. For about 3 years, I was the senior intelligence briefer to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That was during various crises. And then a couple of years later, I was a Latin American specialist and was deeply involved in our Central American policy in the Reagan administration and did most of the speaking for the Pentagon, as, in addition to having written most of the position papers for the Secretary of Defense on Central America. Then the White House decided they wanted me to do this speaking full-time, and they detailed me to the State Department. And in the final 3 years of my career, I gave about probably 300 presentations around the country, many of them on college campuses, frequently before fairly hostile audiences. And they were not just presentations. They were debates and panels against adversaries, normally academics who were very opposed to our policy. And it was a tremendously educational experience for me to be able to do that. And when I retired from the Army, I decided there were very few people in this field of speech coaching. Incidentally, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a speech coach when I retired. It was after I retired and someone told me, you know, you ought to do this because of your background. So I did. So the book that I've just written now is called Bring Home the Bacon: Become a Persuasive Leader with the Proven S3P3 System. And that S3P3 system, it's rather arrogant, I suppose, to say that it's proven, but it's the system that I used in front of all these difficult audiences. It's the system that I teach in my workshops, and it's the core of my book. And I think it'll work for anybody that reads it to make them a more effective, more coherent, and above all, more persuasive speaker, because that really is the key of presentations, to be able to persuade, to be able to bring people to your point of view and to be honest about it, not be deceptive in any way. And that's the heart of the book, Don.
Well, please repeat the book again and where people can get it and your website before we go into the details of just what the book says.
Well, the book, the main point that I bring out in the preface is that some people are born to be leaders. They have a natural charisma just by their sheer force of personality, but that's maybe 1%. And the rest of us have to be able to do so with the spoken word. And speaking in front of a group is the frequently decided as the number one fear in the United States. And it shouldn't be, but it is. It's one of the reasons that there are speech coaches. And I read most of the books on speaking, and I found them somewhat lacking. I didn't find any that gave a step-by-step systemic approach to how to go about organizing a presentation, organizing your knowledge, and then being able to write on the brains of your audience with your thoughts. And that's what I set out to do, and I went through a lot of rewriting and doing it. I spent loads of time rewriting. James Michener once said that he was not a great writer. He was a great rewriter. Well, I don't know if I'm a great rewriter, but I certainly did a lot of it. And I finally got it to fit into a way that I think is organized, it's systematic, and it's very systemic. And it will make people far better speakers than they were before they read it.
Well, where can you find the book? Amazon? Do you have your own website?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm redoing my website. I'm going to take it down now because it is basically focused on other areas, and I want to now, I'm dealing with my webmaster now to redo the website so that it reflects more the bacon aspect. And all you have to do is go into Amazon and in the search box type in Bring Home the Bacon, and it'll bring it up. And I would recommend you look inside and then decide whether this is the kind of a book that will help you. It's an e-book, and the paperback is actually has more information in it. It has an appendix that I put in that sort of reflects my origin. It's called The Model for a Winning Presentation, the Philly Cheesesteak. And I really do. It's not a joke. It's not being whimsical. But I was back in Philly at one time eating my favorite food there, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, here's the perfect metaphor for a presentation. What separates a Philly cheesesteak are the rolls made at Amoroso Bakery, and anybody from Philadelphia knows that. And the key part of a presentation is the opening and the closing, how you introduce your subject and how you really go for the sale at the end. And in between, you've got the technical information, but That's all in the paperback. It's not in the ebook. So I think the paperback is probably a better instructional method than the ebook would be.
Couldn't agree with you more, as I believe that reading a book that you're holding is always better than using something else. Let me ask you a question. You mentioned you have a three P's on preparation. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the preparation of a presentation, first of all, you've got to gain intelligence on your audience. I guess I'm reflecting back to my background as a military intelligence officer. But you have to know, what are their problems? What are their concerns? Or what are their needs? And if they don't have any problems, then don't waste your time with the presentation. But everybody does. And I don't think most speakers really go in and get that. And the intelligence that I describe in the book, I call it the macro and the micro. The macro is the general information you have. How many people? What are their education? What is their, in our multicultural society right now, how many people speak English as a second language? Therefore, you've got to have to change things a little bit when you deliver it. The micro intelligence is what really makes them tick. What are they concerned about? What are their problems? I'll give you an example, Don. When I was going out speaking to college campuses, on college campuses, I would get a request. The State Department would get the request, and I would go out. But I would call ahead of time and talk to the student organizer. I wanted to find out just what it was that they were concerned about. I knew they were opposed to our policy, but I wanted to get into the details. And then when I determined that it was going to be probably a pretty tough gig, I would say, listen, I'll come out a day early. Why don't we go out and have pizza and beer? And I would take them out, and I said, and I'll pick up the tab. That, of course, is always attractive to a college student, that someone's going to treat them to pizza and beer. So we would go out, and I would learn a lot about the audience, and most importantly, they would learn about me, that I wasn't some knuckle-dragger coming in, coming out, or one going with the party line, that I had a master's degree in Latin American studies, I spoke Spanish, I'd lived in Latin America, and therefore, perhaps my ideas were worth listening to. But if I hadn't made those telephone calls and hadn't had those meetings, it would have been a really tough show. So I think you want to get as much intelligence as you can on your audience ahead of time, whether it's in business or in government. And then from there, you then start to plan how to go about. What is your approach to speak to them? An analogy that I used on, and I didn't put it in the book, but I've always used it in my workshops, is you have a car that's out of gas, and you want to drive it from point A to point B. Well, you've got to get gas in there, but you've got to get the gas cap open to put the gas in. And if you don't get the audience's mind open, you're not going to get all your factual data in. So that, again, is that opening, developing rapport, showing that you do have their best interests at heart and your own interests, and see where you can intersect your objective with their needs. And that, I think, is the first step you have to do in the planning aspect of a presentation.
Couldn't agree with you more. But, Larry, you know, people say you should not talk to the audience, you should talk to the clock in the back of the audience or something else. What do you say to that?
What was that? To the people, what you say in the back of the audience, honey?
Well, the clock. They say you should not look at the audience, but rather look at the clock at the back of the audience.
Oh, that old idea. Some of the ideas, Don, that are out there about overcoming nervousness are just absolute nonsense. One of them being the famous thing that came from I'm sure it was a joke by Winston Churchill. He said, think of your audience as naked, then you won't be as intimidated. I'm sure he said that in his lighthearted way, because Churchill was a magnificent speaker. The other one is one you've referred to, look at the back of the room so you're not intimidated by people and they're rolling their eyes or looking at you. Yeah, you must have human contact. You've got to be looking at them. And what I recommend to people is to divide the room into quadrants. And you look at a group, say about three or four back if it's a large audience, and you look at someone there. And when you're looking at that person above the hairline, the people to the left and right and front and back will think you're looking at them as well, then shift to another. But always be looking at human beings. You're looking at their eyes, and that will motivate you, and it will bring them. If you read that the audience is not happy with what you're saying, then perhaps you've got to change things a little bit. It's like a quarterback looking at the defense before he executes the play. You've got to know how the audience is setting up. And after a while, you'll find that you are developing that rapport and you are coming across and you're getting your point across then. And this works in sales and government and whatever aspect you do when you're communicating with people. It works. I told people, they say, well, I don't really speak that much to groups. I said, what about a PTA? How about you go there and you don't like something that is being said? Stand up and make your point, but do it ahead of time by getting as much intelligence and then crafting your presentation along that way.
Couldn't agree more. Larry, since we last talked, and we've been on a couple of programs together, something came up. There used to be a time when if I saw an audience doubting what I was saying, I would get a little flustered. And then someone pointed out to me yesterday that you have to believe in what you're saying. And that belief will sometimes overcome a lot of other things. What do you say to that?
Well, I agree with that completely, Don. The idea of having a belief in what you're saying. For instance, back at when I was in State Department, one of the things that State had in the performance evaluation of people is that they had to be supportive of certain programs, and that would be in there. And therefore, a lot of people would volunteer to go out, but I just knew they were not going to be good ambassadors for the United States. And I would recommend certain people not go out, because I felt that they were not in belief of what we were doing. And an audience can read through. They can see if a person is a phony or realistic. Now, that doesn't mean that you go out there and you blindly support a policy or that you do not like. Then stay back and let someone else go out and do it. But the audience will be able to see that. And I've felt sometimes an empty chair would be better than some people going out to speak. And that's why I always, whenever they said, listen, this is going to be a really tough gig, do you want to take it? I said, absolutely, I want it, because I wanted to be the one out there. Sort of like a relief pitcher wants to be the closer to come in on it. So enthusiasm, passion, and a belief. And when you disagree with things, bring it out. For instance, I would say when I was out there, listen, we got a lot of really bad people in the Salvadoran Army, and we're trying to correct that. And not go out there and say, and a lot of people that I knew and my conservative friends said, you shouldn't say that. You should be supporting them all the time. I said, no, these guys are not a good reflection of the profession of arms, and I'm not going to. And that's not what the U.S. government is about. So you be honest with it. An audience will respect you when you are honest, when even if they disagree with you. And I normally had kids come up to me after a presentation was over and said, I don't like what we're doing in Central America, but you really seem to know your stuff and you were with it, so I'm gonna start to rethink things a little bit and question my professors, who many of them were very opposed to what we were doing. That's why I say it was a tremendous educational experience for me in doing that.
It certainly reflects on you when we're talking here. Larry, I guess my next question, how do you deal with someone? I was at a dinner at my club, and they had a woman at the club who was a very young woman on diet and how to improve your health through diet. And there was one woman in the audience that kept contradicting this young girl, and very condescending. How do you handle, people who are there not to elicit knowledge, but to show off their own knowledge? How do you handle something like that?
That's one of the things. I call them snipers, that they're in the audience and they just want to impress that they know so much. And let me give you an example. I was speaking at Cornell University, and I was on a panel with three people who were very, very opposed to our policy and therefore were antagonistic towards my views on it. And a gentleman stood up who was older than the other students. And I remember very clearly he was dressed all in black, and he had a couple of gold chains on, and he was probably in his 40s. And he stood up, and he asked a question, and I answered it. And he kept on repeating it, and I answered again. And finally, the third time, I said, wait a minute, you're not asking a question. You're just trying to show off. And you're taking up the time of the rest of the audience. And I'm not going to let you have all the fun. I'm going to let other people harass me. Well, at that point, the audience starts to laugh. And that was sort of a turning point. Even my adversaries on the panel, the three professors, they started to laugh at it. And this guy goes and he storms out. And I just looked at the audience. I said, was it something I said? And they laughed again. So I think treating it with a bit of humor, but pointing it out, and here's the key. You want to set it up so that that person who is asking these antagonistic and condescending questions, put them that they are keeping the audience, the rest of the audience, from having their chance to ask questions, and you're not going to let them do it. You want to have everybody have the chance. Therefore, the audience now supports you instead of that person who they may agree with on their position, but that person is taking their valuable time up. You also find that the questions then, after you've established that little personal rapport, they become a little more supportive or a little less antagonistic towards you. But because it's simply rudeness, and most people want to have a civil relationship and a civil discussion when they're speaking.
Larry, let's turn to business. Many of us have to make crucial presentations to smaller groups, boards of directors, executive committee. What are some of the tips that you would offer to them out of your book?
Well, that of course is what I do most of the time now. I work with companies that have to make an oral presentation as part of the proposal process. And one of the things that the government did about 20 years ago when it made the orals a more robust part of the process, it was Federal Acquisition Regulation 15, they said that no longer would professional speakers or marketing people be allowed to make the presentation. It had to be the technical experts, which means that IT, software developers, engineers would then have to do it. And the potential, the future of a company could depend on their ability to make a sale, because it is a sales presentation. And so one of the things that I do when I sit down with them is I say, okay, we're going to start off, what is it that the government wants? And in your book, The Janus Principle, you brought out in there, and it's something that I bring out in my workshop, don't recommend what you want to do, recommend what the customer wants done. And that is something that I see constantly, because government RFPs are rather poorly written. There's a lot of boilerplate in there, and the government may not know what it wants to do, and therefore companies come up and have that problem that they, what is it that the government really wants? Well, they've got to make the best judgment on that. If they interpret correctly, they're gold. If they interpret incorrectly, they're just dead in the water. So that's one of the areas that I do, and it's to a small group. Evaluators normally are no more than four people, so it is a small group that are making it. And one of the things that I train them in is, first of all, using PowerPoint. Don't overload everything with PowerPoint or your slides. You want to be able to have the key information in there. And the PowerPoint slides generally have to be sent about 2 weeks in advance. So the evaluators have already looked at it. So don't try to go and repeat everything that's on there. Just pick out the most important part, put it on a 4x6 card, and as the slide comes up, you just say what is the most important part. And the other thing, have the computer in front of you, so you don't have to turn around and look off the screen. You keep looking at the evaluators while you're making your presentation, and getting to the point and staying within the time limit. That's an extremely important part. So I bring that out in the book. And that's also in the article about the oral presentation, the appendix, where I talk about the Philly cheesesteak being an example. I've got a lot of information there on how to deal with a small group like that.
The name of your book, that you brought it up again?
Okay, it's Bring Home the Bacon. And let me tell you how I came with that title. I'm in the Project Management Institute of Washington. I'm probably the only person who's not a project manager, but they're the ones that have to make the presentation, so that's a good market for me. And a few years ago, I was asked to be the dinner speaker to speak on oral presentations, and I said, great, be wonderful to do it. And then about 4 or 5 days before that, they called me frantically. They said, you know, we don't have a title for this. Do you have anything you can say, a zippy title? And off the top of my head, I hadn't thought about it at all. I said, how to bring home the bacon with your oral presentation. And the guy said, that's a great title. I said, it really is, isn't it? So that's how I came about. I wrote a number of articles on it. And then when I was going to do this book, I was thinking, you know, that probably is the best title. And in the United States, everyone resonates to that, bring home the bacon. You know what that means, making the sale, getting the money in. So that's how that came about. But also I wanted to bring it in and make it as an aspect of leadership, not just presentation skills. In other words, presentation skills are the means to become a good leader. And so the subtitle is Become a Persuasive Leader with the Proven S3P3 System. And we haven't really discussed what that is. Visualize three pillars, structure, substance, and style, supporting a pyramid of planning, practicing, and presenting. And the book basically goes in great depth to the planning, practicing, and presenting. And so I think for a large corporation, for small businesses, this is the best way to go about making a presentation. And the key thing, Don, is it's an easily internalized system. It's not so complicated. It's really systematized common sense. This is how you would go about it. You want to know what your audience is needing, what kind of information. You want to know how to practice. And one of the things in the practice, a part of the book that I emphasize, and it's something I bring from the military, it has a rather macabre term, but it's a practice system we use in the military called the murder board. And I know that a lot of people don't like that, so just think of it as a simulator, and that's what it is. It is to the presenter what a flight simulator is to the pilot. You make your mistakes when they don't count, and so then when you get up there to actually make the presentation, you've got this thing down pat. And that is a key that I put in all of my coaching workshops, and it's the essence of the book.
It's one I should take to heart because my wife always complains that I never really prepare for whenever I go out to speak and just begin. Larry, I'm going to ask you another question. You know, people fail to realize that what they're really doing is they should be presenting what they can do for the listener rather than what the listener can do for them. I see this in presentations and guests I have. They talk about what they can do rather than what they do can help the audience. Would you, if you understood that convoluted question, could you address it?
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's the old thing of sales as well. You don't talk about the features, you talk about the benefits. And right up front in a presentation, I'll go back to the oral presentation for a government contract. One of the things that I emphasize that they do, that the project manager, who'd be the lead presenter, gets up there and shows just what the key discriminators is, what this particular company can do that no other company can do, and make sure that you're right on that. And don't come out with terms such as we're a full service or we're a world class and these words that mean nothing at all. But just specify what it is that they're going to get. And perhaps you might have some proprietary software. You might have something that nobody else can have. And you bring it out that only with your company can this customer be able to gain from it. And then at the end of the presentation, after all the experts have given their sub-presentations, then the project manager gets back up and he repeats that. You know, there's an old saying about speaking. It's tell them what you're going to tell them, and tell them what you told them. And that is very, very valid for now. So bring out what is unique about your company, unique about the capabilities you have that no one else can bring, and how it matches with what the needs are. But it always has to be oriented towards the needs of the customer, the needs of the audience in such a way. When I was doing this in political things, when I was in the government, I wanted people to understand that what we were doing, in fact, what I would do, I would start at the beginning at a college campus, and they were all opposed to me. I would say, how many here believe in democracy as the best form of government? Everybody's hands went up. I said, how many people believe that a military dictatorship is the best form? No hands went up. I then proceeded to describe how Nicaragua and Cuba were indeed military dictatorships, and I had the proof on it, the numbers, there was no question about it. And therefore, I was pointing out, so I said, so your actions are in favor of a military dictatorship. And then I would go into the psychological concept of cognitive dissonance and all that stuff. And all of a sudden, they were finding that they perhaps were not on the side of the angels as they thought they were. And so it was fun to watch that change go over the audience on it. But I think you're right. It must be what the audience needs and what you as the presenter are going to be able to do to solve their problem. And that I think, if you can get that across into their minds, their mind is open up, that gas cap opens up, and you can pour that factual gasoline into their mind.
We're talking with Larry Davis. Name of your book again and where people can get it.
Bring Home the Bacon, Become a Persuasive Leader. And one of the things that I like on the book is that, well, I did it when I retired from the Army. It was over at the building next to the White House. It's got a name now. I forget what it is, but it was called the old Executive Office Building. So people were getting up saying nice things about me. And then the Deputy Director of Public Liaison for the White House, who was not scheduled to speak, but he was there, he said, "May I speak? I have a letter for Colonel Tracy from the President of the United States." And I say, "What? What is this?" And he gets up and he reads this wonderful letter in which Reagan referred to me as an extraordinarily effective speaker because of feedback he'd gotten. And I always put that in my bio, but I didn't really edit it. But when I was doing the book, I said, "I'm going to put that on the cover." Because I figure Ronald Reagan is still better known than I am. So I took advantage of that. And he was my hero anyway, so I liked doing that. But it adds to that. So you'll see that if you go into Amazon and you just bring it up, take a look at it, look at the contents, look at the table of contents, and see if it will help you. And I sincerely believe it will, because it does help all of my clients that I work with.
We've been talking with Larry Davis, his book again, Bringing Home the Bacon. Thank you so much for being with us today. I'm glad you finally came on my program, because you have such a lot to say for my audience.
Well, I'd be delighted, have been delighted to be with you on this, and just something that I love to do. I love to speak about speaking. I want to do everything I can to cause people to be as persuasive and as articulate as they possibly can be to achieve their full potential. So many people simply cannot do that. They never achieve the potential they can because of their inability to speak clearly and persuasively. And then there are other people that aren't that smart who can talk a monkey out of a tree. And I want the smart people to be able to speak well, so that we're not controlled by dumb people who speak well. Well,
on that note, Larry, we say thank you and have a great day.
Same. Thank you very, very much, Don.
You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.